Welcome to Visionaries Global Media, your number one source for podcasting entertainment. Visionaries Global Media, envisioning excellence on a global scale.
Welcome to episode 5 of the SJP Wrestling Podcast. On today's show, we are joined again by Mags. He returns to discuss Clash of the Champions matches from the past, some suggestions from Twitter and some suggestions from myself. Quite a few of the matches he hasn't seen before, so it was a really interesting discussion. Again, similar to a previous episode during Clash Month on the show, where we are looking at past matches, potentially through fresh eyes. I'm really interested in getting an opportunity to talk about things like that and have people viewing contests for the first time, especially if it's personal favourites of mine from my wrestling fandom. As we come to the end of Clash of the Champions month on the show, next week we will be looking at the latest Clash offering from the WWE, which is being broadcast this Sunday. I'd like to hear everyone's thoughts and feedback on the matches and the show in general. You can get in contact with the show on Facebook and Twitter at SJP Wrestling Pod. And you can find me, your host, Si, at SJP Words on Twitter. However, that's next week's show, a modern day product. This week's show and past product is what we're looking at today. So let's get on with our conversation with the always excellent Mags, the Podfather himself. Take a little trip down memory lane and review some great old school classic Clash of the Champions matches. Hiya Mags, how are you doing?
I'm not doing too bad, yeah. Excited to be back on the show. Yeah, it's glad that you gave the invite out.
No, definitely. Anytime you want to come on, and more than happy to have you on. I'm glad that you accepted the invite. It's always great talking wrestling with you. It's fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so how you been? It's been, what, 3-4 weeks since we last spoke?
Yeah, busy. Started a new project with Tanner from Headlock Talk called Radio Techers, and that's absolutely just doing gangbusters. We joined a network with Anthony, who formerly did Smart to Death. He's kind of come away from wrestling and gone on to real sports, and we're doing so well. It's a lot of work, a lot of kind of juggling my schedule with the amount of podcast projects I'm involved in. But yeah, it's good fun. So
I was going to say, surely you haven't got any spare time at all. I mean, you must only sleep about 3 hours a night, surely.
Right, so I'll give you some context, right? We're recording this on Tuesday, the 22nd of September. Tomorrow, I have 3 podcasts to record. One for Badlands, one I'm doing a guest spot for Matt for Good Cop Bad Cop, and then I'm doing Radio Techers, and that's at 1 o'clock in the morning. Then Sunday I'll have 4 to do. I'll have 5 rounds, and then I'll do that straight after the UFC at about 6 o'clock in the morning. Then I've got the one, the Twitch stream that I do with Josh for the wrestling, the WWE pay-per-views. Then I'll have another episode of Radio Techers where we talk about the weekend's football. And then about 8 o'clock, we'll have Talk at the Table with Matt Willis and just have a grand about wrestling. So, yeah, this week is a busy-ass week. It's very much time management.
Yeah, definitely. And it's great as well how diverse some of those topics are. I mean, you said that the new show is about football, isn't it?
Yeah. It was, I kind of fell into the project by accident almost. It was, Tanner wanted to break out from just doing the wrestling show. He started doing like gaming shows and kind of like weird and wacky new shows, and he was really interested in starting a football one with the new season coming up. He asked if I'd help with the pilot we clicked straight away. And then the week after, he said, do you want to come on again? It was like, absolutely. And then straight after that, it was a case of, yeah, let's keep this partnership going. It's so much fun. Then we just, it just exploded. I ended up on Visionaries like yourself. And then we've gone on to this new network, Shooting the Sports Edition. Yeah, it's been an absolute madness. It's in the last 3-4 weeks, we've just absolutely done gangbusters. Yeah, really, really proud of it.
I mean, as a football fan myself, I can recommend it. Yeah, I've listened to it quite a few weeks. Not every week, but most weeks I've listened.
Yeah, it'd be cool to have you on.
I've enjoyed it. It's great. It was I find it interesting. I find a lot of more, I suppose you'd say, mainstream or more named football podcasts, you know, like the ones that the newspapers do or Sky do themselves, or they've always got slight biases to them, and they've always got to toe a certain line, I suppose. But when I listened to yours, it was just like listening to a couple of mates talking football, but more knowledgeable than my mates, if that makes sense. So that was, no, I've enjoyed it. So I can, any other football fans happening to be listening to this, I can recommend it very, very highly.
Oh, you don't know how much we appreciate that. That's absolutely amazing. And that was kind of the vibe we were going for. We will never ever claim to know everything about football. It's literally just how we saw the games that happened, how we kind of interpret the news that's going on in football. Yeah, and it's like you said, it's about two mates just having a chat and just there being a microphone there to record it. But yeah, I'd love to extend the offer for you to come on the show and have a chat about football one day. It'd be great fun.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, just let me know. We'll sort something out. That's great. So, for now then, considering how busy you are, shall we get on with it? Shall we talk a few Clash of the Champions matches?
Yeah, let's. I mean, when you came and said that this would be the topic, and because I wasn't a WCW guy, we kind of couldn't really get it where we live. I'm to my own kind of detriment, I'm not that caught up with WCW. It wasn't my wheelhouse. So I know like the big stars that then, I know the really big matches, but I didn't watch a lot of the Clash of Champions. So when you did the episode with Conrad about Ricky Steamboat and Ric Flair, I thought it'd be kind of a great kind of follow on from that to almost take me on a learning journey about wrestling. Yeah, and I felt like with the picks that you've gave for the matches to watch, I do feel like I've gone on kind of a knowledge journey of older WCW. So yeah, thanks for that.
No, that's great. I mean, I watched quite a bit of WCW, but didn't have access to all the bigger shows. It was like Worldwide and so on. Then, of course, you got it. You could get tapes and so on. But I never really got the opportunity to watch it as and when it was happening, especially some of these, because I was a bit too young. But it is sort of my go-to if I've got a spare few hours and I want to have a watch of some wrestling. I don't really know what to look at. I always find myself bringing up the WCW section on the network and going from there. So it's kind of my go-to, especially what I've done with these matches. I mean, in all clarity, you know, makes sure everything's all transparent. It's not all my selections. Some people suggested via Twitter, my show's Facebook page. A couple of people messaged me there too. But I tried to pick from the suggestions. I put some of my own in, but I also tried to pick matches that maybe have been a little overlooked or don't get the love maybe they require, or aren't the big storming main events like the Steamboat Flares that me and Conrad may have discussed that everyone's kind of knows of. I also decided to have a cut-off point with Clash of the Champions 27, which is the first time we see the big orange one, Hulk Hogan, turn up. Because the very next event after that is the Bash at the Beach in 94 when he wins the WCW World title on his in-ring debut. So I know that after that point in time, things do, money-wise maybe it went up, but quality-wise it very much took a nosedive in WCW. So I sort of thought that's where I want to end this conversation about these certain matches, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely made sense. And I've never been the kind of fan that portrays to know everything about wrestling, because no one does. Even guys like Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer don't know everything about wrestling.
Oh, exactly, so, yeah, definitely.
I've loved going on this journey, and like I said, I know the wrestlers. Don't get me wrong, I know these guys, but I've never really sat down and watched these matches. So it was fun going through them. And when you said, yeah, there's not too many big ones, and then the first one's like a 45-minute match, I was like, oh, you arsehole, Simon.
Yeah, I rewatched that one today myself, to be honest. I remember being a 45-minute time limit draw. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the others, there's a few others that are a bit shorter than that. Try and balance it out. But yeah, should we start there? Clash of the Champions 1, start at the beginning?
Let's go for it.
Okay, I mean, there was two matches from Clash 1, wasn't there, that we had a little look at?
There was. The main event.
Yeah, that's right. Before we get on to the making of Sting, I guess, we watched Wyndham and Luger versus Arn and Tully. Mm-hmm. What did you think of that? I'm assuming that was the first time you might have seen this match.
Yeah, again, the majority of these matches is the first time that I've watched them. And mm-hmm. the thing that really kind of stood out to me from watching this match, because obviously you said the Sting and the Flair one first, but because this one came before that in the show, I watched the tags one first. And the thing that stood out to me was how fast paced this match was.
Yeah,
four guys who you wouldn't kind of really say are renowned for like having fast paced matches. I mean, Lex Luger is like almost the king of rest holds. but yeah, this kept up a massive frenetic tempo for all the 10 minutes. And the crowd ate up every single second of it. It was just so, it was exciting to watch because of how into the match that the crowd was. It was a really good start to this little journey I went on. And kind of like I did with the last show, I went and looked up the scores on Wrestling News Observer to see what Dave Meltzer gave it. And he only gave this match a 3.5 rating, which, you know, I would have given it way higher than that. I'd have gone at least 4 just because of how there was no botches in it. It was a very quick, very heavy paced matches. And I really, really enjoyed it. So I'm surprised that Dave kind of didn't, or he'd give it a middling score. But yeah, it was a good start to this journey.
Yeah, I've seen this match quite a few times, but not recently. So watching it back for this show, yeah, I got the same feelings. The crowd were just absolutely wild, weren't they? I mean, a little context, I suppose, building into that, is Luger just left the Four Horsemen. So the feud there with Arn and Tully up against Luger, and it was Wyndham as his partner. And of course, the Horsemen in 88 were, you know, just absolute heat magnets, as we see with Flair later on and so on. So that would, I suppose, help with the atmosphere there. But just certain moments as well, like, for example, the crowd reaction when Tully Blanchard hits Barry Wyndham with a slingshot suplex, which was one of his main go-tos in the ring, but Wyndham kicks out. The reaction is just insane. And I think it's a real testament to how tag team wrestling, when done properly, as again, we'll discuss later on in the show, because there's a few more matches that we've looked at from there. Tag team wrestling, when done properly, you don't need gimmicks, you don't always need tables and chairs and so on like we saw in much, much later matches. If it's done properly and the guys are talented and the crowd are into it and there's a good story, then that's kind of all you need. And I'm a huge Arn Anderson fan anyway. I'm a huge Barry Wyndham fan anyway. So this ticks boxes for me. But I really, really enjoyed watching this one back. Yeah, I thought it was brilliant.
Yep, I have to agree with you. It was again. When we spoke on While We Watch, I told you how much tag team wrestling means to me. It was really my kind of wheelhouse in terms of wrestling. And again, this, like you said, it ticks all the boxes. There's nothing really amazingly flashy. There's no, it's definitely, it's definitely a mid-80s kind of match. It's a very kind of almost John Cena kind of moveset, all pretty basic, but it's all done to perfection. It looks, the punches look real, the shots look heavy. They probably were, to be fair, and yeah, it was just a great match, and it's not often that you say that about a Lex Luger match, but yeah, I really did enjoy it.
Yeah, Luger, to be fair, Luger, he looked great in this, didn't he? But then you look at the guys he's in there with, I suppose that helps, doesn't it? So, and again, I think a crowd reaction makes a big difference to anything. If you throw in the weakest looking right hand in the world and the crowd go mental for it, I mean, it gives a slightly different impression than if you throw a weak right hand in it and you're greeted by crickets, I suppose, maybe.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, as you said earlier, when that tag match finished, we got onto the main event of that show, Sting versus Ric Flair. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts of this one?
Yeah, and this was almost like a contrast to the tag match. Guys who you know can keep up a really fast pace, and this was much more of a slower kind of deliberate, almost like measured pace. I think obviously they knew that they were going to go 45 minutes, so it was a case of conserving energy, not basically shooting your load too early in the match. And what I felt was that I was being taken on like an emotional roller coaster all the way through the match. It was there was high points and low points, and you thought that Sting was gonna get the victory, and then you thought Flair was gonna get it. It was interesting that at the beginning the announcer said there had to be a result in this match, and then they did the draw. Which yeah. if you think if WWE pulled that kind of shenanigans now, how much stick would they get over wrestling Twitter? This match would have been absolutely ripped to shreds, but it was a great match to watch, and you can tell that Sting was I'd say green, not in terms of skill by all means, but in terms of being able to kind of dictate a match. You could tell that this was very much a Ric Flair led match.
Oh yeah.
And again, I went to the Wrestling Observer scores, and Dave gave this 4.75 stars. And do you know what? I can't disagree. It was a really good match to watch. 45 minutes went by so quickly. But who was the kid? Who was the one of the judges? Well, I don't think he even was a judge. I don't think he had a vote. But I've seen his face before, and I could not picture where his face was from.
The younger lad. He was in The Wonder Years.
Yeah, that's
not the main character. I mean, he was the main character's older brother, was he?
Yeah, I remember him now.
Yeah, so he's very much of that time, isn't it? Sort of 88.
He's in the matches again, like later on in the show. He's not in this show, in other shows. So he must have had a big fascination with WCW. But yeah, going back to the match, it was superb. I absolutely loved it. I thought, and knowing the matches that you picked for me to watch, I thought this is going to be the start of a journey, and the last match is going to kind of like be the culmination of it, and it absolutely was. You did really well to kind of like bookend these shows with Flair versus Sting. It was some great picks.
Oh, excellent. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it again. Thank you very much to people on Twitter as well who suggested a couple of these. So, but yeah, with the Sting Flair match, I mean, you can see, I suppose, people talk about psychology in wrestling, don't they, and the storytelling aspect. I think this is on display so strongly here, with the obvious mission of getting Sting elevated up to the next level. They want to create this next superstar, and it obviously works. There was the stalling of an injury to Sting shortly after this, or a little while after this. But at this point in time, I think that 45 minutes with Rick, with Flair, I think that it was mission accomplished. Sting came away looking like an absolute star. Flair came away looking like he'd survived by the skin of his teeth.
Mm-hmm.
The one moment where you can almost see the referee batting Sting on the leg to tell him time's running out, you need to hit the Stinger splash and so on. Yeah. That's something that I sort of noticed and thought, well, okay, maybe that is, you know, a sign of Sting's potential and experience. It was his first real big time contest. I mean, that to me was a real tiny little thing. It was, I really enjoyed it again. But again, I'm a big Flair fan. I'm a big Sting fan. This is my go-to. This is my wheelhouse, for want of a better term. And I really enjoyed it as well. Plus, hearing Jim Ross on the call as well is always great for me. He's the soundtrack to pretty much every wrestling memory I've got. So
him and Tony, you could tell that it was night and day compared to Jim's work in AEW, because he's had so much passion for these shows. Mm. And Tony's obviously, he's the almost exemplary professional. So they really did add to this, the passion and the kind of like the commentary that Jim gave. It really did like make me get more invested in the match.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, I knew the results going in, of course, obviously. However, towards the end, I'm still sort of shifting towards the edge of my seat, thinking, okay, what's going to happen next? And I know it ends in a draw. It's ridiculous. But I suppose that, again, is testament to how talented these guys are and how good a match it was to get that reaction out of me now in 2020.
Yeah, and on my side of the coin, I didn't know the result. So I was that person.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a... I was the ones at the edge of my seat getting excited for the match. I think when I heard the there had to be a result at the beginning, I was kind of realizing that, yeah, this is probably going to go to a draw in it. And especially we having judges there, which you don't really see a lot in wrestling. I thought, yeah, it telegraphed it a little bit, but it didn't stop me getting excited with the match. It was just a well-timed, like I said, very slow but deliberate match to watch, and it was a great pick.
Yeah. I enjoyed it. I mean, one aspect that did stand out, I suppose, that I haven't noticed watching this before, was how much stalling there was at the beginning from Flair. And I understand in a match, you know, Flair is obviously famous for going 45 minutes, 60 minutes, 90 minutes and so on. And he does require a certain level of stalling, a certain level of rolling out the ring and so on to make that happen and also tell the story. However, a few years later, I read about Flair doing something very similar to Scott Steiner when they wrestled a Clash of the Champions event in a main event there for the world title. And that was supposed to go a time limit draw, only 30 minutes on this occasion, I think. But I was doing research for an article I wrote quite a few months back. And it came up that Steiner thought that Flair was actually sort of sandbagging him in the match. He was slowing down intentionally to make Scott Steiner not look as impressive, to sort of take the shine off him. But then I watched this match with Sting, and he's doing pretty much exactly the same thing. And the first time seeing it since I've read up on this and done that research, the first time noticing it, it doesn't come across that way in this match. I think maybe the suggestion of it in the Steiner match led my mind a little bit, but it was funny from my standpoint seeing similar tactics, but obviously done for more of a storyline or storytelling point of view, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. I think maybe that this is a case of context being like important. I think this was obviously, like you said, it was a match to make Sting into a main event guy. Maybe perhaps Scott Steiner. I mean, as much as I like Scott Steiner, is mentally, he's not the most sound person, and
no.
he does have a very, very short temper. So, what Flair is doing in terms of trying to like make the crowd and the audience feel that he's doing everything he can to avoid wrestling Steiner, maybe Steiner took that the wrong way and thought that it was Flair trying to screw him over, where in Flair's mind, he was doing what he does best, and that's making his opponent look $1 million.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, speaking of the great tag match we just watched, might as well stay on tag wrestling after that match at Clash One. We also watched Rick Steamboat and Dustin Rhodes coming up against Arn Anderson, but with a different partner this time in Larry Zbysko, didn't we? How did you find that one?
Yeah, this was the Clash 17 match, right?
That's right.
Again, like I was saying with tag wrestling, this ticked every single box for me. I loved the kind of reveal of the different opponent when Barry Windham came out in his street gear with his arm in a cast. I knew as soon as I saw the dragon's head coming down the ring, I knew exactly who it were. But the crowd and the commentators were kind of playing along as if they didn't know. And then when they did the reveal, Ricky Steamboat may very well be the most babyface in all of wrestling.
Yes, definitely.
I love the heel work between the enforcers, Arn and Larry, how they kept the faces apart for long periods. They did the old distracting the ref, switching in and out of the ring. That's all, everything I love about tag team wrestling. It's that simplicity, but the storytelling, it just gets me right in the feels. I loved seeing like a young, hungry Dustin Rhodes, who you could tell he was excitable and full of energy, but clearly was inexperienced when he was kind of the almost the perfect foil for someone like Steamboat, who was so such a good ring general. I feel that when Dustin got in the ring, it was just the hot tag. I've spoke about it time and time again. The best thing about wrestling for me is when you get that hot tag and your face wrestler comes in and absolutely cleans house. Yeah. Dustin got that rub. It was absolutely brilliant. And then I just loved the fact that they went and won the match. It was just I loved it. It was a great pick, and again another one that Dave obviously really enjoyed as well, because he's another one who gave it 4.25 stars.
I loved it. I again right in the sort of time period that I enjoy, sort of late 80s early 90s WCW NWA, and you're saying about the hot tag in wrestling being a huge been one of the best things you can see. I totally agree, and this is done fantastic in this match. With like the, I suppose, almost sly tags from Anderson and Zbysko as well. Yeah. I mean, on one occasion, there's a sly tag on a sunset flip, and the baby face wrestler doesn't realise and gets caught, and that's happened 30 seconds after the same thing. A similar scenario, just before, and it sort of builds up that anticipation of the tags being made, and the old trick of just when the baby face is about to make the tag, the heel wrestler comes into the ring and distracts the ref, so the tag's not seen. It just builds up the tension until finally that tag is made, and the reaction, just the crowd goes mad, and it's so simple, and it's so, I don't want to say overused, but you see it again and again and again. But to me, when it's done right, it's fantastic. And I agree with you. You can't beat it.
Yeah, it's timeless. It's absolutely timeless. I've always said that tag wrestling is the simplest way to tell a good story in a ring. You don't even need any kind of like backstory, as long as you've got four wrestlers who know how to work a crowd and get. Like I said, it was the simple things that happened in this match. They isolated one of the faces for long periods of the time. You have the other face at the other side of the ring getting frustrated, jumping in, and then when they get a tag, the ref hasn't seen it, so it doesn't count. But then when the heels get a tag, it's kind of waved off, and you get that frustration as a fan thinking this is absolute bullshit. Then when they do get that hot tag, everyone cheers, and everyone's just—it's just simple things like clotheslines and bulldogs that the crowd are just absolutely on fire. It's absolutely brilliant. I thought this was a damn near perfect tag team match. I loved the mystery partner thing, just to add that little bit of nuance to it. Yeah, it was a great pick. Another brilliant tag team match. And I think in the one of the other matches that you picked, that they mentioned that this was Dustin's first ever like major title. So it was cool to see that as well.
Yeah. Talking about the hot tag aspect being something that we see all the time, there was actually something in this match that I have not seen elsewhere before. I mean, I don't know if it's happened and I've just missed it, but there's an occasion where Arn Anderson has his opponent in a Boston Crab. Mm-hmm. And Larry Zbyszko is leaning over the top rope when the referee can't see him and pushing him in the forehead, pushing him in the forehead to make him lean back further. And I've seen the whole grabbing the hands and putting on somebody's arm for an abdominal stretch and so on. But a Boston Crab with your partner pushing on your forehead to make you lean back further just tickled me. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. Tiny little thing like that, but it really made me laugh.
It's absolutely great heel work. It was brilliant. Yeah, it was, like I said, it was a damn near perfect tag team match for me.
There you go. There you go. So from excellent heel work, we'll take one of their opponents, who we say is the ultimate babyface. And we had a look, we'll stay with Steamboat, and we had a look at Steamboat versus Funk, didn't we, from Clash of the Champions 7?
We did. This was a weird match for me to watch because I kind of didn't know the context, obviously, because like I said, I haven't really watched a lot of what's going on. But obviously the... picking up what the commentator said, I assumed that Ricky Steamboat was the number one contender and Terry Funk kind of wanted that number one contender from him. So it was weird that it ended how it did with the DQ. If you were really interested in kind of getting that number one contendership, why would you kind of draw the DQ with the attack on the macro? I enjoyed the in and out of the ring work. I thought that was refreshing, especially considering this was the late 80s, early 90s, and you didn't really see a lot of that kind of stuff. I love Funk. This was kind of like it felt like the genesis of him being like middle-aged and crazy almost. Mm. And again, Steamboat is massively the definitely the ultimate babyface. But then when we get the Luger save, it made sense. It absolutely made sense. This wasn't about Terry Funk being number one contender. It's about the Lex Luger heel turn and him coming and basically getting what he wanted, which was the recognition of the number one contendership. The chair shot bit, it made me laugh because it was so telegraphed, it's unreal. Yeah. He goes to get a chair, brings a chair in, the begging from Ricky Steamboat, I loved it. That really just adds to him being a babyface. It's... please don't attack. I've just gone through this brutal match with Terry Funk. I thought that was some really good character work. But then when he stands up and kind of moves to his back, knowing he's going to get hit, and then Luger tickles him with the chair, literally just barely makes contact, then throws the chair away. It looked so funny. I just didn't get it at all.
Yeah.
And then obviously then we get Sting coming out to actually make the save. Yeah, I enjoyed it. It wasn't my best match of the lot, but I enjoyed watching it just because it's Terry Funk and it's Ricky Steamboat, and you can't really go wrong with those two guys. Dave gave it a 4.25. I felt that it was a little bit generous, probably like 3.5 maybe. But yeah, it was a great match.
Yeah, again, I enjoy this myself. I understand where you're coming from with the finish. But at the same time, it was very much... Funk had other things to do as well. He was going on to face Ric Flair, I believe, after the ending of a Steamboat Flair match. Funk got involved and... He pole drove Ric Flair through a table, I think, is if I'm thinking of the right event. Again, like you said, the start of his middle-aged and crazy sort of gimmick from there. But again, with Steamboat, you're seeing the ultimate babyface, as we keep saying, aren't we? I mean, he's popped up a few times already on this show. When I came on Badlands and had a chat with you about my Mount Rushmore, Steamboat was my last pick.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed to hear you say that nobody had actually chosen him before, because I think the guy's absolutely incredible.
Mental.
I think he's amazing.
Yeah.
No, it really surprised me.
It really is. For someone who was a babyface in pretty much everywhere he went, and he won titles everywhere he went, it is a shock to, especially to us at Badlands, how he hasn't been picked so many times. But I think after you came on, I think maybe two people in a row picked him afterwards. So you've started the ball rolling.
Open a few people's eyes, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. another one we looked at was again involving Mr. Flair. But on this occasion, wrestling someone who was prominently a tag team wrestler, as far as I remember him, in Bobby Eaton. And that was from Clash 15, wasn't it? And to me, Eaton versus Flair, on paper, looking at it, I'm thinking this is going to be incredible. I keep saying it over and over again. I'm a big Flair fan, but I'm a big fan of the Midnight Express. Bobby Eaton, I think, is incredible. So seeing these two in a singles match, I thought was going to be superb. How did you find it?
Yeah, again, I know Bobby Eaton as one half of the Midnight Express. So seeing him in a two out of three falls match for the title, it was quite jarring, really. Because
it's strange, isn't it?
Yeah, and I thought that this could be the kind of match where he breaks out from being known as a tag team specialist, and this is the match that makes him shine. And I don't think I got that in this match. I think it was just too short for me to kind of get invested with Bobby Eaton as a singles wrestler. Perhaps if it was like maybe half an hour to 45 minutes long, and it was like him really kind of coming out of that safety of a tag team to really give Flair one of the worst matches he's ever had, maybe I would have like kind of believed in him a little bit more. But it was a decent match. Dave gave it a 3.5, and I kind of agree, because the quality of the wrestling was there. I love the Alabama Jam finish for the first. But
it's great, isn't it, that move?
Yeah, but I think the match only went about 15 minutes or something like that, and the first fall was around the about two thirds in. So he then gets the count out a couple of minutes later. I'm wondering if he actually got a legitimate injury, because he loses the second and third pin very, very quickly. Rare to see the figure four actually get a pin. That's normally kind of the ref counts and they get up. But the match was very, very good, don't get me wrong, but it just didn't kind of scream out that Ric Flair had made someone else into a superstar. It was kind of like a rare miss for a Ric Flair kind of making someone as a match.
Yeah, I suppose with Bob Eaton in this match, this example, again, like you say, it went short. It looked like it went short, so perhaps there was an injury there. I'm not sure. But you're right, it's almost like the final step wasn't quite there. And I'm talking with regards to the match itself, and potentially with Bobby Eaton as well. There's almost like the last step, the last little bit of sparkle for this match, and Eaton as a singles wrestler wasn't quite there at this time.
Yeah, I get that. And if you go back to the Clash 17, I think on Bobby Eaton's like in either the first or second match, so it clearly didn't kind of push him to the upper echelons of the singles card as maybe they wanted the match to.
No, that's right. Which is a shame, because the guy's obviously incredibly talented.
Oh, absolutely. But I think this could have been the breakout match where you look at him as an amazing wrestler, not an amazing tag team wrestler, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, but there was just something not quite there, wasn't there, on this occasion? Yeah, okay. Clash 21. We watched a couple of matches from that, didn't we?
We certainly did.
We had, we'll start with Sting versus another favourite of mine, Mr. Rick Rude. What did you think of this and the wonderfully named King of Cable tournament?
Yeah, I didn't get that whatsoever. Like I said, I had absolutely no context of
The Cable tournament was a tournament put on by WCW basically to celebrate an anniversary of wrestling airing on TBS for so many years. It was either 20 years or 25 years or something like that. So they put this tournament on, and the winner was effectively king of cable television, I guess. But it pretty much meant nothing. It was another idea that WCW had, that I suppose when they're all sat around a table chatting away, discussing what they can do with this and this. It sounds good until they start doing it, but then they're already invested, so they have to carry it on. It didn't really mean anything. I think it ended with Sting versus Vader at Starrcade, I think was the final in Starrcade 92, but yeah, the tournament itself basically meant pretty much nothing. But you had guys like Vader, Rude, Sting, and so on involved, so it produced, to me, some good matches.
Yeah, I mean, any reason to put on a decent match is found me. I just didn't kind of understand the context. The match was... It was definitely a kind of progression in Sting's career. You could see the difference between him on the first Clash, where he was being led in the match, to Sting being the person who you could see was definitely improving in terms of being that ring general. The result was weird. Again, another judge's decision. For me, I felt that Rude absolutely dominated this match, worked on Sting's back. Sting had a couple of moments where he kind of like got back into the match, but every time he did, it was Rude basically took back control. Then with about 90 seconds or something to go, he made another comeback, fought out of the Rude Awakening, which is one of my favourite finishing moves.
Mine too. I love it. It's fantastic. Yeah,
it's a really brilliant
stiff
move.
Stiff drop down. Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah. So then obviously it goes to the judges, and then we had Hiro Matsuda voting for Sting. Zabisco, the heel, obviously voting for Rude, and Ollie voting for Sting, and that was, it just felt weird. I felt that Rude dominated this match, so how Sting won was beyond me, but I enjoyed it. I think this was probably one of the weaker matches of the ones that have been picked to watch. The Wrestling News Observer gave it a 1.25 stars. I think that's a bit mean. I would have given it more just because of how good both guys were in the ring. I'd have said at least a 3-star match. But yeah, it was an interesting match to watch.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the whole judges storyline, to be honest. I'm not a fan of that at all. In any aspect. I mean, the only way I think it could potentially work is if you have judges voting and putting the bad guy over as the winner when they don't deserve it, and the judges are potentially in-ring competitors themselves. You can get a bit of leeway out of that, maybe future storylines out of that. But I don't see the purpose in ringside judges on a time limit. To me, if it's a draw, it's a draw.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially in title matches, if it's a draw, it's a draw. That's that. Obviously, in a tournament, potentially, I see the other side. They're trying to make it so that people can go through to the next round. But if Sting is going to go through, why didn't he just beat Rude? Rude's the US champion. A loss to me doesn't really ever hurt anybody. I think people make a big deal out of that online, that it's so over dramatic. Oh, such and such loss, they're being buried. It's all nonsense.
Yeah. Why
didn't Sting just beat Rude? I mean, there's so many ways you could do it. He's still the US champ afterwards. He's absolutely fine. It baffles me a little bit, to be honest.
And especially when you can build to Sting challenging for the title afterwards.
Exactly.
I've got a non-title win over you. I deserve a title match. It kind of makes sense, but it was in this era where WCW did like using judges, and we kind of saw that rubbing off in AEW, kind of like with the match that they did with the judges. It didn't make sense, but it was a fun match anyway.
Yeah, and I agree that Rude was probably, if you're going on points, Rude is the guy who should have potentially won the contest. Mm-hmm. Sting worked over Rude's stomach, his abdomen, or whatever, for the first 5 minutes or so, which obviously came in later on when he went for the Rude Awakening, and where he'd been worked over. You know, again, great storytelling, but I agree with you. If you're going by judges' decisions, then, you know, Rude should have gone through. It just kind of makes a mockery of the whole judges' thing, I suppose, but... But yeah, there we go. I'm a big Rude fan, so any chance to get to, you know, stick a Rude match on and have a watch is always great for me anyway, so.
Yep, absolutely. It was a great wrestling and taken from us way too soon.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I totally agree. Also, we have a bit more Mr. Steamboat on this show. It seems a little bit Steamboat heavy now. I'm looking at it as a list.
Yeah,
subconsciously. subconsciously somewhere. That's something I may need to look at. I don't know. But we had... Steamboat and Douglas this time, Shane Douglas. We're facing off against Barry Windham and Dustin Rhodes again. So how did you find this one, especially in comparison to the earlier tag matches we watched from sort of Clash 1 and so on?
Okay, so again, I'm going to... probably ask you for a little bit of context here, but we saw Dustin and Ricky Steamboat win the titles in Class 17. Is this a case of Ricky handing the titles to Barry Windham and so that him and Dustin are the champions? I don't know the kind of backstory, but what I did notice almost straight away was how the crowd loved both teams. So it felt like a very much a babyface versus babyface setup. We got a lot of the kind of face in peril stuff, which just works every single time for me in terms of tag teams. I like the kind of hinting towards Rhodes and Windham not being kind of on the same page. There were a couple of like quick tag outs. You could see where Dustin was getting really kind of frustrated with Barry for the beating he was putting on Ricky Steamboat. And then obviously they had the kind of battle that led to Shane Douglas hitting the belly to belly for the pin. I thought it was some really fantastic storytelling. Another really a match that scored highly with me. According to Uncle Meltzer, he only gave it a 2.5, which I think is a shocking score. For
yeah,
this match.
I think that's a bit unfair. Yes,
it's at least a 4-star match. I love the kind of turn from Barry Windham. I've always enjoyed like a heel turn anyway. So it's one of the best things in wrestling. I thought it was a great match.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it as well. I mean, I can't offer a great deal of context to that. This was a suggestion off Twitter, you see. I might have watched this match many, many, many years ago, but putting it on for research purposes to have this conversation with you today, I didn't remember a great deal of it. As it wore on, I could remember the Windham turn at the end, and I like bad guy Barry. I think he's great as a heel, so that was great to see as well. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. And if you say Meltzer marked it that low, I think that's, again, it's all subjective. It's all opinions, isn't it? Everyone's entitled to their own opinion, no problem. But I agree with you rather than he, that is a fairly low score for this. I thought it was worth much more.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, like we've said with the other tag matches on this list, the action is not anything that's out of this world. It's tag team wrestling, but the storytelling is absolutely brilliant. The division between Dustin and Barry, it comes on really well through the match. The frustration in Dustin's face and Barry kind of like not really caring what Dustin thinks and really putting a beating on Ricky Steamboat. I loved it. I thought it was really well played. And then obviously they had the little scuffle, and then afterwards we had the full-blown heel turn where Windham DDTs Rhodes and that's the team over. But yeah, I'm assuming that it was the titles that Ricky and Dustin had won, because it was only about four shows before that, four clashes before that, when they won, unless they kind of hot shot of the titles around quite a bit.
Yeah, but, I mean, four clashes could have been a year potentially.
Yeah, so I may be way off
my mark. I'll have to look it up, and I'll have to look it up, but I can't offer much more context than that. But at the same time, you're almost applying logic to WCW.
that
doesn't
true.
Always work that way. So
that's incredibly true.
On the note of Wyndham's heel turn as well, you mentioned the DDT. What a DDT.
Yeah.
That was Barry Windham so good, wasn't he? The superplex, the DDT, everything he did. He's absolute star. When Wyndham was part of the Horseman, that was probably my favourite incarnation of the Horseman as well, with him there. It just all felt, didn't it?
Because he's a big chap. He must be, what, 6'4", 6'5". He moves like a cruiserweight.
Yeah, definitely. With them big clunky cowboy boots on as well. So.
God awful.
Oh, yeah. It's funny you mention cruiserweights, actually, because the next match, if we're going in date order, was the very next clash, wasn't it? We watched Chris Benoit versus Brad Armstrong. I think this is a little bit of a hidden gem. What did you think of this?
Yeah, when you gave me this match, it was another one that I thought, yeah, this is a weird pick. It's kind of like very out there in terms of all the rest of the matches. Like, they're all huge stars. They're all big names. And even in my kind of limited WCW knowledge, I knew that Brad Armstrong was kind of like almost a jobber to the stars. I mean that sounds detrimental, but he wasn't like known as a huge star. And then obviously you've got Chris Benoit, who around this time was pretty much a nobody. He was more well known for his work in New Japan.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
but. After watching this match, I got why you said it's a hidden gem. Benoit comes out to pretty much crickets, and by the end of the match, everyone's into it. You can tell that Chris's kind of style and his work rate was so different to what WCW was offering at the time. We've spoke about how basic a lot of the wrestling is. It's great wrestling, but it's very basic. There's nothing out there that's flashy, or there's nothing out there what's like almost eye-catching, where Benoit absolutely brought that. It was new. I mean, not to us in 2020s eyes, but to watching this in the early 90s, this would have been absolutely outstanding. And it felt like this could have possibly been Benoit's breakout performance in terms of Western wrestling. And the Dragon Suplex was absolutely beautiful. Just a really, really good match.
Yeah, I this is one of my personal favourites, even though it's only, I think, 8.5 or 9 minutes long. I'd love to have seen more of it. But when I was putting together a list of Clash matches and taking a few off Twitter and so on, I put this one in myself because I'm a huge fan of this match. I stumbled across it because I was watching something else. And this came on maybe before or after or a while ago. I wasn't watching the show all the way through. I was kind of flicking through. And I caught this and I was just like, it just blew my mind. Especially, like you say, for the time. And you look at the other matches around it, whatever match it was I was seeking out at that time would have been my comparison. And yes, nothing majorly spectacular back then, especially with 2020 eyes and so on. But it stands out in comparison to the other matches around it very much. It's very much, it is a little bit ahead of its time. You can see the Japanese influence in Benoit. Yeah,
absolutely.
There.
The hard-hitting style.
Oh, yeah. And it was great. I really enjoyed it. And I find this a little bit one of those hidden gems. And if people ever say, oh, I don't really know what to watch on the network, I always sort of suggest this match. It's the first one that pops in my head when people say, oh, I want to watch something I haven't seen before. I'm assuming a lot of people haven't seen this. So that's
And like you said, it's not a long match. It was, 8-9 minutes long.
Yeah.
But it's there's a lot of good wrestling in those 8-9 minutes. They really kind of utilized the time really well. And yeah, I think Dave, let me just check. Dave gave it 3 stars, which it's a little bit unfair. Maybe going edging closer towards 4 just because of maybe the time frame and maybe
if it was longer it would have got higher.
Yeah, if it were wrestlers who had a more of a history in putting on good matches, like I said, Brad Armstrong, he was essentially a jobber, and Benoit was very, very not as well known in the West as he was in Japan, but yeah, I enjoyed the match. It was always weird when you go back to the network and you see a match with Benoit not being on, he's not being mentioned by name. I mean, I understand why. What happened was absolutely horrific, and you don't really want to promote that as a company as large as WWE. But it is kind of jarring when you see Brad Armstrong has a match and
in singles action or something.
Yeah, Brad Armstrong in singles action. Yeah,
it is. Horrible. I mean, on the note of Benoit as well, it's obviously absolutely terrible what happened. It's awful, and the families, the effect it had on them is terrible. But it is the knock on as well too, the stuff on the wrestling, the network, and there's so much there that I'd love to sit my little girl down and say, watch this. This guy was incredible, but I'm okay watching Benoit matches. I'm not sure if that says anything particularly about me. I don't know. But I'm okay watching Benoit matches. I'm not saying I'm a fan of his later actions, of course. In any way, stretch the imagination. It was disgusting and horrific. It was an absolute tragedy. But I'm okay watching the matches. But I got that concern of, I want to sit my little girl down and say, watch this. This is brilliant. The 2004 Rumble, WrestleMania 20 main event, the matches with Shawn Michaels and so on. And then, of course, his earlier stuff with Guerrero and everyone else. But my concern is if she turns around and says to me, well, tell me about him, Dad. Or she said, or she looks him up herself. That, so I end up not watching. And it's almost like, it's almost like there's extra layers to the awfulness of what he did, yeah, that knock on through the years, isn't there? You know, and even, you know, it's just a horrific thing. It's not a nice thing to think about in any way, stretch of the imagination at all. But
nope, yeah, I totally agree. For some context, there's a book called Ring of Hell by a guy called Matthew Randazzo.
Yes, I've heard of this. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an amazing read. You can see his kind of like anti-WWE bias in it, but when you get down to like the facts, he kind of transitioned it from being like a look at just what happens backstage to in terms of WWE. But because obviously all the Benoit stuff was going on, he kind of turned it into a story about Benoit. And there's some really interesting like points that he makes in that book. So I'd recommend you going out and getting hold of a copy if you can find it and just giving that a read, because it really does open your eyes to why Chris was like he was. And again, this is not me condoning his actions. They're absolutely deplorable. No, yeah. But the amount of kind of pressure he put on himself, the amount of pressure that was put on him from the likes of Stu Hart, and the kind of mindset that he had, being like a small guy, and basically he punished himself all the way through his career for the very slightest mistakes. Mm. There's a point in the book where he speaks about, he asked Chris Jericho for a little bit of feedback on one of his matches, and Chris said, yeah, it was really good. I would have done such and such a thing differently. And he found later on that Benoit took that so much to heart that he found a dark cupboard backstage, and he was kind of like really punishing himself by doing like loads of Indian squats to...
I read about this, yeah.
He really kind of took criticism like that to heart. And then obviously we had the issue with Eddie Guerrero, and Eddie Guerrero in WWE was kind of his rock, his like stability. And once Eddie went, it was just, he had nobody. It was just Chris was left to his own devices, and it was the diving headbutt, and then the massive amounts of painkillers and steroids that he took, and his brain was absolutely mush. I think the coroner said this is a brain that's got 90 years worth of dementia. That's the kind of like damage he'd done to his brain. So he was not a well man, no, when he did, yeah, what he did. It still doesn't excuse what he did, but the context is there that the wrestling world does kind of play a massive part in affecting these guys.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose you look now, the ruling of no chair shots to the head in WWE, it's all for, you know, ultimately aiming in the right direction with looking after these performers. Again, yeah, we don't in any way, shape or form condone what happened at the end of Benoit's life. It is a horrific tragedy, but again, you look at some of the in-ring content the guy produced, some of the matches he produced, it's almost a shame that future generations can't enjoy that because of his actions there. But obviously a lot of other people suffered a hell of a lot more than us because of what he did, so there we go.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a mad tangent that we went off on, but
yeah, that was a bit of a weird one. We're going on a bit of should we talk about something a little bit more lighthearted?
Yeah, but you didn't expect that. Yeah, let's talk about the setup for Hogan.
I was actually going to ask the question, Max. What did you tell me you watched 5 or 6 times this week?
Oh my god, it was brilliant. Was that on that Clash as well, or was it?
I'm not sure of the number. It might have been on the one after.
No, I'm sure it's on. It must have been on Clash 22. It must have been.
Okay.
Because I remember watching it, and then I said to you, when you go onto WWE Network, it kind of gives you you are right, because I think that's the thumbnail for Clash 23, okay, the Shockmaster. So you are right, I think. But yeah, the Shockmaster, Oh my God! I mean, we've wrestling Twitter have waxed lyrical about this event, but my God! As soon as I saw that, I messaged Simon and said, "I'm distracted here. I've got to watch this. I've got to watch this Shockmaster stuff." And it's just, it's sheer brilliance. It's absolutely a comedy of errors, but it's just so funny to watch. And I feel so bad for Fred Ottman, because he got lumbered with this horrific gimmick. He crashed his way through a piece of drywall, fell over. He's
lost his helmet.
His stupid stormtrooper glitter helmet fell off. He was having to mime kind of the movements of someone talking when it was clear that it was Ollie Anderson talking in the background.
He started as well, didn't he? You watch it, he starts almost miming these movements before before the voice comes. It's so surreal. It's so weird.
It's mental. Anything that went wrong. It was just absolutely brilliant. And you could see him pointing to Sid Vicious and like saying, "Come on, if you want a piece of me." But then he don't say that for like another 30, 40 seconds. It's so funny to watch. How the rest of the guys didn't just like fall about laughing is unreal. But I did note that they lowered the volume on David Boy Smith saying, "He's fallen on his arse."
Yeah. But, I mean, you've got to say as well, and I don't say this very often, but you've got to say fair play to Sid Vicious here, because if he's an absolutely dead straight face, he's yelling, he's shouting, he's been as serious as he possibly can be, you know, with his silly hair and shouty sweatiness, you know. But you look at the whole segment, it's so weird. You got Davey Boy Smith talking with his back to the camera, basically blocking Sting, and it's just everything about it is just, it's just so weird and bad, but to a point where you watch it and it makes you laugh. It's that
even
it's that bad.
Even before the heels turn up, when Sting and Davey are on the sofa, every time Sting stands up to like get the crowd riled, David Boy stands up to do pretty much the same thing. It was like he was almost mimicking him. But then Flair says something like a comment about, Flair for the gold is cooking, and David Boy just runs with it, and he flogs that dead horse so bad. Everything he talks about is cooking. For, and he's thinking he's on for like about 2.5 minutes. He's like, "Sting is cooking. The Davey Boy, the British Bulldog is cooking. Ric Flair is cooking. The crowd are cooking. Someone in the back with a couple of pots and pans is cooking." It's just mental how he just clutches onto the word cooking, and just suddenly everyone's Gordon Ramsay and they're all in the kitchen doing a bit of cooking.
It is so fun. I mean, it's obviously on the WWE Network, but there's a few people who listen to this show who listen mainly because they're sort of friends of mine, as opposed to wrestling fans who may not have the network. It'd be easy to find on YouTube if you look for Shockmaster's debut. It's got to be seen to be believed. This is wrestling at its funniest, but also at its worst. It's just an absolute calamity. It's just pure comedy gold. Please, go seek it out if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's everything that when wrestling fans have to defend wrestling, if you want the perfect argument to why you should never watch wrestling, just point people to this, because it's so ridiculous. But it's why us wrestling fans love it, because it is so bad.
It's one of them you just can't defend, isn't it? You just got to take it on the chin as a wrestling fan. But yeah, okay. The last match we have from our little look at Clash of the Champions matches, I suppose. I started off by saying sort of pre-Hogan, but he does appear on this show, doesn't he? Pre-in-ring Hogan, shall we say. We finish how we started with Ric Flair versus Sting. Six and a bit years further forward in time from the original. What did you think of this one?
I thought this was a great way to bookend my education on Clash of the Champions. It was I mentioned in the first match that Sting looked green in terms of being a ring general. I think in this one he was getting close to his peak. It was just a massive contrast, and how he kind of was more a rounded kind of ring savvy wrestler that was able to dictate the pace and the direction of a match. It was such a dichotomy to the first clash. And then obviously we've still got Flair. He's got that knack for being devious, kind of do yep. anything to win mentality. And the way it was kind of always on the back foot in this match, I really enjoyed it. It was, like I said, it was night and day compared to the first one where Flair was doing the leading. This was a sting-led match. The ending felt like it was too much of a swerve with Sherry. You can always tell whenever Sherry's involved with a face, she's going to turn on him.
And
you got that when she came in to help Flair. She did well with those frog splashes from the top rope to lay into Sting. But what the kind of annoying thing for me was that this was all kind of instead of being like a Sting versus Flair match, who were two of the biggest stars in not only in WCW but in wrestling at that time, this was just a tool to build up for Flair versus Hogan. I just didn't at all. That didn't sit well with me. I felt like Sting can feel a little bit aggrieved for that. But it's the wrestling business. And that being said, it did lead to what would be the biggest revolution in wrestling in probably forever, with Hogan being the champion in WCW, and then obviously the heel turn and turning the wrestling world on its head. So I do get it when you've got someone like Hogan at that time who was the face of wrestling. He's the number one guy. I enjoyed the match, though. It was, like I said, it was a really good match. I felt that Sting did well to lead this match. It was a good way to bookend this kind of like chat about Clash of Champions. Dave Meltzer gave it 3.5. I think I would have probably given it a little bit more, maybe 4, just because of how well Sting has come on since the first clash. It was a great match and a great way to round off the show.
Yeah. Again, Flair versus Sting to me it's almost timeless, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It was the last Nitro as well. There's the match. I think it was Great American Bash 90. I think when Sting finally won the world title, and it's timeless. It's very much got WCW stamped all over it, hasn't it? But yeah, you're right. The whole looming presence of Hulk Hogan coming into this is everywhere to see. Flair makes an expression walking to the ring, and the commentators are citing, oh, he's already thinking about Hogan. The bell hasn't even rang yet for him versus Sting. I mean, this is a title unification match. This is their two versions of the world title being converted to one. And all they're doing is rabbiting on about a guy who's not actually wrestled for them yet. Again, I can understand why. It's Hulk Hogan. It's the biggest signing they've had. It financially, it makes a huge difference to WCW going forward. Of course it does. Mm-hmm. But at that moment in time, maybe one or two mentions less of Hogan would have been a bit more beneficial to the match itself.
Telegraphed what was going to happen. They mentioned him so much that he had to be involved.
Yeah, exactly. And you're going to get Hogan Flair above Hogan Sting, aren't you? Because they want the whole light and dark, good guy, bad guy dynamic the following month when Hogan defeats Flair. Also, that feud there, Hogan defeated Flair at the Bash at the Beach, and a couple of matches later, Hogan actually retired Flair in 1994, which is quite comical when you think about it now. But on the note of Sherry as well, when Flair pulls her in front to take the bump when Sting comes over the top rope, did you see how hard she hit that floor?
She can bump like the best of them. She really, really can. It did sound very, very, very painful. Mm. But one thing I did love in this match, and it's something that we didn't really get in all the other matches that we've spoke about, is Bobby Heenan on commentary.
I've got a note of Heenan about Heenan myself. Yeah, you're spot on.
The way he did it all the way through his WWE run as well. WWF run, sorry. The way he kind of like, it's got so much bias for Flair. It's unreal. I think he really stands out as as one of the very, very best, not only managers, but commentators. The guy could pretty much do it all. His razor quick wit. I love everything that Bobby Heenan does in this match.
Yeah, he's brilliant. He's always is brilliant, isn't he? Like you said, the bias towards Flair. You got the obvious comparison with the 92 Rumble and so on, haven't you? Mm-hmm. And I just love all of that. It's just, he was just so good in everything he did. I recently rewatched WrestleMania 5 for the show when I was talking to Comrade, and Heenan's all over that show as well as a manager and so on. And it's just, again, cutting interviews with his members of his Heenan family. And like you said, just so quick. Somebody says something and it's like lightning, the response. And it's all so funny. The guy was just an absolute genius. Absolute genius. And yeah, maybe considering it was, wasn't it 3 years this week, Mr. Heenan passed away. Maybe that's a good place to leave this chat then, citing how wonderful Bobby was, even on an event where we're sort of cringing at the prospect of Hogan coming in and taking an in-ring quality down very dramatically.
Yeah, pretty much.
Before I let you go then, Mags, do you want to let everyone know where they can find you online, your various shows and your social media links?
I apologise for this, but it's probably going to be longer than all the talks of the Clash matches.
Just give me a shout when you're done, because I'm going to put the kettle on, all right?
It's definitely going to be longer than the Benoit and Armstrong match. But basically, you can find me on Twitter at DAJ Kirby. I won't run through all my content because there is absolutely loads, but you can definitely find links from there. What I do want to shout out, though, is the networks that I'm involved with, Visionaries Global Media with Simon. I'm involved with the Chairshot Media Group and now with Shooting the Sports-ish. So go and check them out. Go and give them a follow because I put out content, but these guys put out way better content than me, so definitely go and check them out and go and give them a listen, a follow, a sub, some feedback, yeah, all that stuff.
Okay, great stuff. Well, thank you very, very much for coming back on again and discussing some old school WCW and some old Clash of Champions matches. Really grateful for you coming on. It's always great fun talking to you, Mags. I always really enjoy it, so yeah, hope to have you back on again soon.
Yeah, anytime. Like I said, we in the DMs, I've got kind of a lot of stuff like in the fire. But once I've kind of like sorted out a regular roster, yeah, just hit me up and anytime I can help out, you know, I'll always be there throughout that bat signal.
No worries. We'll try and sort of fit something in, I don't know, 3 a.m. in about 6 weeks' time, or, you know, when you've got some spare time.
I'm busy at that.
Okay. Well, try and line up our diaries, mate. But no, thank you very much. Really appreciate it, buddy. Thank you.
No problem. Thanks for the invite.
No worries. Speak to you soon.